You'll remember, if you were here last week, that I'm looking at the concept of God that's shared by the main monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, what I'm calling the theistic concept of God. I'm not looking at the differences in these religions' conceptions of God, I'm looking at the things they have in common. Last week, I looked at the first three properties in my list of the properties that theists attribute to God, his personhood, his transcendence, and his immanence, as I called them. And this week I'm going to start by looking at omnipotence. Now, straight off the bat, we might most naturally define an omnipotent being as a being who can do anything. But sadly, we're not going to be able to rest completely content with that definition, because there are various questions one might raise over what the word anything should be taken to include. And three of them are on the handout. One, can an omnipotent being make an object that is both perfectly spherical and perfectly cubical at the same time? One and the same thing be perfectly spherical and perfectly cubical at one and the same time. Can he do that? Two, can an omnipotent being make mistakes? Three, can an omnipotent being commit suicide? So let's look at one first. All theists are agreed that the answer to this first question is no. Have a quick look at the top end of the cautionary note over on the second side of the handout, if you like. But my claim with that cautionary note in mind is that all theists agree that the answer to this first question is no. But the suggestion is that this doesn't reveal an inherent confusion in the concept of omnipotence. A perfectly spherical and perfectly cubical object is a logical impossibility. So even if we do define an omnipotent being as a being who can do anything, he wouldn't be able to make such an object. The logically impossible isn't anything. It isn't even a possibility. That's why we call it the logically impossible. The clue's in the name. So, no need to change the definition yet. What about the second question? Well, I think this is a little bit more puzzling. Can an omnipotent being make mistakes? Consider for a moment a mathematical question. This is the question. How many ways are there of getting 50 or more questions right on a test composed of 100 questions? So getting the first 50 right and the next 50 wrong would be one. Getting the first 60 right and the next 40 wrong would be another. Getting the first 40 wrong and the next 60 right, well, that would be another, and so on. How many ways do you think there are in total? Put your hand up, okay, so think, oh, yeah, I wonder roughly how many ways there must be in total. Come up with a figure. So put your hand up if you think that there must be more than 10 ways of getting 50 or more questions right on a test composed of 100. There must be more than 10. Yeah, good. Keep your hand up if you think, well, the answer must be higher than 100. Yeah, everyone's, well, not everyone's hands up. But keep your hand up if you think the answer must be higher than 1,000. Must be higher than 1,000. I'm dropping my hand, but don't let that affect you. Keep your hand up if you think the answer must be higher than 10,000. Just a couple of hands. Must be higher than 1,000,000. Must be higher than 10,000,000. 100,000,000. Yeah, answer goes down at 100,000,000. Okay. So I might say of everyone in my audience today that they have the ability to believe that the answer might very well be no higher than 100,000,000. Remember that you have that ability, because I'm about to do my best to take it away from you. The correct answer is, in fact, quite a bit larger even than 100,000,000. In fact, it's so much larger that the computer that I got to run a program to determine it for me could only manage an approximation. The correct answer, then, is approximately the number which is given right at the bottom of the handout of side 2. Have a look at that big number now. All right. So all of you, in the end, were able to believe that the answer to my question might be something, number no greater than 100,000,000, all of you were able to believe that something, the answer might be something which of mathematical necessity it isn't. Right. So you had an ability to believe that. Let's suppose for a moment there's been someone in this room who, when I asked whether or not you were able to believe that the answer was 10, 100, etc., etc., had just kept their hand up, and I kept going until I got to this figure, and then they said, nope, that's it, that's the one it must be. And they got, in fact, rather than just the approximation, got the precise figure in a way that my computer couldn't. Would such a person have been a less powerful mathematician than the rest of us? Well, obviously not. They'd have been some sort of mathematical genius. But someone might argue, well, that such a person wouldn't have had an ability that the rest of us had. They wouldn't have had the ability to believe that the answer might very well be less than 100,000,000. Now, they couldn't put their hand down. So I just can't believe it's less than, until they got to this figure, they weren't able to believe any of these things could be right. So this person would argue, so this person is more powerful as a mathematician than us, because they have a mathematical ability that the rest of us wouldn't have had. Sorry, this person is less powerful than us, because they wouldn't have had the mathematical ability that we did have, viz. The mathematical ability to believe that the answer might be something wrong. So that's what someone might argue, but I think we'd see, if we were listening to that argument, that something had gone slightly wrong with it. Their confusion would have arisen from their describing as a mathematical power on our part what was really a liability. Our ability to believe a false answer to a question isn't actually an expression of power, it's an expression of weakness. What conclusion am I wanting us to draw from this example then? Well, the conclusion is that some abilities, which one might, if one didn't know enough, think of as powers, are really more correctly called liabilities. And the more powerful one is, the less abilities of this liability sort one will have, not the more. So our ability to believe that the answer to my question might very well be no greater than 100 million, an ability that all of us had, was actually a liability. And so by removing from you that ability, if you believe me about the computer and the answer, then I've removed from you the ability to believe that the answer might be less than 100 million. By removing from you that ability, I have actually increased your power, even though I've taken away an ability. So given that the ability to make mistakes is actually better thought of as a liability and not a power, so we can say that the answer to the question, can an omnipotent being make mistakes, is no. Omnipotence implies no liabilities whatsoever. We can make mistakes, all of us in this room, God cannot. So there is something that we can do, viz. Make mistakes, that God cannot do. And that's why my first stab at a definition of omnipotence, being is omnipotent if it can do anything, can't quite be right. Can I adapt it? And being is omnipotent if he has all powers that it's logically possible to have, but no liabilities, perhaps. Well, let's leave that as the second stab at a definition and turn to the third question. Can an omnipotent being commit suicide? Consider the following argument. We certainly have the ability to commit suicide. We are dependent on many things for our continued existence. If these things altered, we'd cease to exist, and we often have it within our power to alter one or more of these things. Is our dependency for our continued existence on these things a strength? Is it a power, or is it a sign of weakness? Is it a liability? Should we say, I have the power to be killed by lots of different things, therefore I am more powerful than Superman, who has only the power to be killed by kryptonite? Or should we say, I have the liability to be killed by lots of different things, therefore I am less powerful than Superman, who only has the liability that he can be killed by kryptonite? Well, there's a cautionary note about that too, for aficionados of Superman. But it seems to me, obviously, that matter aside, we should say the latter. To be dependent on something other than oneself for one's existence is a sign of weakness. Superman can only be killed by kryptonite, so he's much more powerful than we are, but he still has a weakness. God, being omnipotent, would be stripped of any element of this liability. There'd be nothing that could cause him to cease to exist, not even himself. Well, it's the not even himself bit that I've sort of tagged on at the end there that might be controversial. And I think that it is controversial for a good reason, in that there is a complicating factor here, viz. That sometimes, partly what I've just said, it is a power for us to be able to commit suicide. Consider the following situation. You know certain secrets which will, if they fall into the hands of terrorists, enable them to set off a nuclear bomb in a large urban area, killing millions. You've been captured by these terrorists, and they're about to torture you to get you to reveal these secrets, and there's no way you're going to be able to resist this torture, and there's no way you're going to be rescued. But you have a suicide pill issued to you by your employer. You have it in your hand. They've not discovered it yet. You could pop it into your mouth, bite down on it, die instantly, painlessly, and then the torture wouldn't reveal the secrets because you'd be dead. In such circumstances, I admit that your being able to kill yourself is a power, not a liability. It's an ability which, in those circumstances, it's good that you have. But these, it's obvious, are very desperate circumstances. God could never be in anything similar. So for him, it would always be a liability. The ability to commit suicide is only a power when one's circumstances are very bad, and one's suffering from terrible liabilities in other respects. For committing suicide to be one's best option, it's pretty obvious that then other options have to be pretty terrible, and God will never be suffering from such liabilities, will never have such terrible other options. So for him, it would always be a liability to be able to commit suicide, so he won't have it. So how, at the end of all this, if I'm right, would it be best to define omnipotence? I would suggest we define an omnipotent being as the most powerful being that it is logically possible there could be. An omnipotent being is a being with the most power-granting set of abilities. How are we to understand what being omnipotent in this sense entails? Which abilities are in this set, which are really powers when God has them, and which are actually liabilities and to be excluded. Well, here we must acknowledge, I think, that we soon run up against some limits imposed by our own finitude. But I suggest we can equally acknowledge that we can make some progress. Whenever one is considering an ability to do something which of logical necessity disbars one from being able to do something else, one will have to use one's intuition to decide which of the abilities is most power-granting, the answer thus leading one to decide which to ascribe to an omnipotent being and which to deny of him. Is it more power-granting for one to be able to create a stone so heavy that one couldn't oneself lift it? Or is it more power-granting to be able to lift any stone? Plausibly, my intuition tells me it's the latter. Being able to create a stone so heavy that one couldn't lift it would then be a relative liability, and if so, an omnipotent being would have the power to be able to lift any stone, and he wouldn't have the liability of being able to create a stone so heavy that he couldn't lift it. Now, obviously, in using one's intuitions in this way to decide which things are powers and which things are liabilities, one's making an evaluative judgment. Which of these would it be better to be able to do? And evaluative judgments vary to some extent between people. Perhaps you think it would be better to be able to create an object so heavy that you couldn't lift it, rather than to be able to lift everything. Well, if so, you'll have a different understanding of which abilities to pop into the set of omnipotence and which to keep out as liabilities. But this worry, I think, can be overemphasized in two ways. Firstly, it's not a worry about the meaning of omnipotence, just a worry about how much agreement we're likely to be able to reach about which abilities are entailed by omnipotence and which not. And secondly, evaluative judgments aren't actually completely different from person to person. We've already seen that we value true beliefs over false, and thus think that being able to make a mistake would always be a liability. Thus, an omnipotent being could never make mistakes. And even on the stone paradox, as you probably know that's usually called, almost everyone's intuition is that it would be better to be able to lift anything than to be able to create something one couldn't oneself lift. Imagine two potential superheroes popping up in the room, one of them saying, "I have the power to lift any stone." We'd think, "Well, that's pretty impressive." And the other one says, "I have the power to create something so heavy I can't lift it." We'd think, "That's not so good." The first one is obviously more powerful than the second, I say. But you might disagree, and you might say, "Oh, no, I think the second superhero is terribly exciting, and I'd be reading his comic strip over and above the first in a shot." Well, okay. But insofar as we can reach agreements, and on that I suggest we probably can, we can reasonably hope to be able to make at least some progress in understanding what is entailed by omnipotence in the ad hoc fashion. However, there are two points which ultimately curtail our complete understanding. Firstly, our lack of omniscience means we won't be able to tell of some abilities whether they're powers or liabilities. We'll know that they're one or the other, but we won't know which, and we'll be able to know that we won't know which. An example: is it a power or a liability to be able to believe that the binary form of Goldbach's conjecture is provable in a finite number of steps? Well, we don't know. All we can say is that if it's a power to believe this, God has it. If it's a liability to believe it, God doesn't have it. Secondly, for some abilities, whether they count as powers or whether they count as liabilities depends on what other powers and liabilities one has, such as the case of suicide. Ultimately, therefore, one would need for full understanding of omnipotence to be able to compare sets of logically co-possible abilities to see which set one's intuition told one was overall the most power-granting. And that sort of reflection I've not really begun, and as to finish it would require one thinking about an infinite number of sets, each of which has an infinite number of members. We can easily see that this will be beyond the capacities of any finite agent, and thus we might say only God will fully understand what it is to be omnipotent. But fortunately, we don't need to reach full understanding in order to reach satisfactory understanding, and that's what I suggest we've got. So I conclude that the concept of omnipotence is clear, even if some of its entailments lie beyond the grasp of anybody other than God himself. Now, being powerful, even all-powerful, isn't any good if one has no wisdom in using one's power. Indeed, is it not Spider-Man who tells us that with great power comes great responsibility? Fortunately, God is omniscient, so he will have the necessary wisdom, and omniscience is the next property on my list. So, omniscience literally means, then, all-knowing. Anyone who's studied philosophy will know that there's no consensus over what knowledge is. Fortunately, we don't need to find out exactly what it is in order to make some progress, at least, with characterising omniscience, for we may say that a being is omniscient just if it's the case that for all statements, if a statement is true, the being knows that it's true, and if it's false, then the being knows that it's false, i.e. it knows the truth value of all statements. So far, so good, one might think. But consider this. There are, or at least prima facie it seems that there are, some true statements about the future. For example, consider the following sentence. At the end of the lecture, when I finish presenting my prepared material, at the end of the lecture, I'll ask if there are any questions. Okay. That's an indicative sentence with a pretty clear meaning, so surely it's either true or false. Let's assume, for the sake of future argument, that it's true. That's what will happen. Okay. Now, we might have different views over whether or not any of us know that to be true now, but I imagine that we'll all agree that none of us in this room know it to be infallibly, know infallibly that it is true now. None of us can be said to know it infallibly, even if it is true, as none of us can be said to have ruled out all possibility of our making a mistake. It is just possible a meteor might destroy the room just after I finish the lecture, as I take in breath to ask if there are any questions, kills us all, I don't do it. Now, initially at least, it looks as if there's a good argument for the conclusion that God will know it infallibly. Why? Well, God's omniscient, so if anything that's true, he'll know that it's true. Therefore, if it is true that I'll ask questions, as we are assuming for the sake of argument it is, then he'll know it. Okay, so he'll know it. But why say he'll know it infallibly? Well, he's omniscient, so if anything that's true, he'll know that it's true. It's true that he's omniscient, so he'll know that he's omniscient. So he'll know that there's no possibility of his ever making a mistake, so he'll know that there's no possibility of his ever having made a mistake about this, and so he'll know infallibly that I will ask for questions. If it is true that I'll ask for questions, as we're assuming it is, then God would infallibly know it. Surely every theist would agree with that. Well, actually, no. Not all theists do agree. So here's a controversy internal to the theistic camp. Not all theists do agree that God infallibly knows the future. The reasons for thinking that he doesn't are usually linked with viewing God's eternality as his being everlasting inside time. So before I can wrap up how we should understand omniscience, I need to consider the next property on my list, eternality. So let's put omniscience on hold for a moment and look at this. All theists are agreed that God is eternal in the sense that he has no beginning and no end in time. But they divide over whether this is because he is outside time or inside time but everlasting. The traditional theistic view, i.e. the traditional view amongst those who've thought philosophically about theism, is certainly that God is eternal in the sense of outside time. That's the consensus traditional view. On this view, let's call it the atemporal view, God knows infallibly everything that will happen at times that are, from our point of view now, future. But he cannot be said to know now what will happen at times that are, from our point of view and his future, because his point of view technically isn't a point of view inside time at all. It's a point of view from outside time. So on the traditional atemporal view, the right answer to the question, does God know infallibly that I'll ask for questions when I finish this lecture, assuming I will, is the one that I've already given. Yes. Technically, he doesn't know now that I will, but atemporally he knows infallibly that I will. Okay. However, many have felt some dissatisfaction with the atemporal view. Why? Well, there are various reasons people come up with, some quite general ones from the philosophy of time, but I think an interesting one arising internal to religion is one's understanding of prayer. Theists who place a lot of emphasis on God's being able to change his mind in response to prayer, observing that only a temporal being can change, for to change requires you to be in one state at an earlier time and another state at a later time, theists observing that often depart then from the traditional atemporal view and instead see God as being inside time. So let's call their view the temporal view. Atemporal view, God's outside time. Temporal view, he's inside time. Of course, he's inside time, but he didn't have a beginning and nor will he have an end. He's everlasting and in that sense eternal, but he's inside time. If one is a temporalist, then God's omniscience only requires of him that he knows that which it is logically possible to know at the time that it is now. Let's ignore the theory of relativity, for to solve the prayer problem, if it is a problem, God's now has to be pretty much the same as our now. Okay, presumably then God's omniscience entails that he knows now, infallibly, all propositions about what is now, the past. Yep. But if one is a temporalist, one usually suggests it doesn't entail infallible knowledge of propositions that concern states of affairs that are now the future. Specifically, the move temporalists usually make is to say that God's omniscience does not extend to him infallible knowledge of the future actions of free creatures. They usually say that because of the following argument, which they accept as a reductio of the suggestion that a temporal being can have infallible knowledge of future free actions. So here's the argument in a minute. If God were inside time and his omniscience were to entail, but he knows now that I'll ask for questions at the end of the lecture, then God would now have the belief that I'll ask for questions. But if I'm going to be genuinely free to choose whether or not to ask for questions at the time in question, then at that time I have to have it in my power either to ask or not to ask. But if I'm going to have it in my power in the future either to ask or not to ask, I'm going to have it de facto in my power in the future to make a belief that God currently holds, viz. The belief that I will ask, false. But if God's omniscient, I cannot have a power to make a belief that he currently has false. I can never have such a power. So I cannot have the power either to ask or not to ask in the future, viz. Then I'll have to ask. But if I can't do anything but ask, I can't really be free when I ask. What goes for future decisions about my asking for questions goes for all other decisions. So if God is temporal and omniscient about the future, nobody can be genuinely free. But it's obvious people are genuinely free. Oh dear. Now, there are quite a few things that a temporalist can say in response to this argument. They might give up on that notion of freedom. I mean, it's a controversial notion anyway. But the most popular move for the temporalist is one that parallels with regard to omniscience the move one makes with regard to omnipotence. Omniscient temporal being just has to know infallibly that which it is logically possible for an omniscient temporal being to know infallibly, obviously. And the temporalist may insist, well, it's not logically possible for a temporal being to know infallibly the future actions of free agents. Thus, God's not knowing infallibly what I'm about to do is no more of a restriction on his omniscience than his not being able to create a spherical cube is on his omnipotence. Future free actions are, by definition, things that cannot be known infallibly by anyone, even by God. They wouldn't be free actions in the future if they could be known infallibly by someone. Now, if one's right that this move on the part of the temporalist seems to reduce the amount of control God has over things, one can perhaps sort of cheer oneself up a bit with the thought that God's not infallibly knowing the future of the world that he's created is solely the result of his freely choosing to put into that world creatures with this sort of freedom, something which he needn't have done and something which indeed he couldn't have known in advance he was about to do. With that infallible certainty, he couldn't have known it anyway. Nevertheless, given that he has created a world with free, that is, amongst other things, inherently unpredictable creatures in it, it's no longer possible for him to know infallibly what it is the future of that world will be. Well, that in any case is what temporalists on the issue of divine eternality usually find themselves wanting to say about omniscience. And these temporalists sometimes go by the name of open theism. So if you think, oh, that's an interesting view, I'd like to know more about it, that's the key phrase to look up. All theists agreed then that God is eternal, in the sense he didn't come into being at some moment in the past, neither will he cease to exist at some moment in the future. However, as I've indicated, they divide over the issue of whether this is because he's outside time or because he's inside time, but everlasting. And this disagreement on the nature of divine eternality has knock-on effects for theists' understanding of omniscience. An atemporalist will see God as infallibly knowing all true propositions, including any concerning times that are, from our point of view, now future. A temporalist will see God as infallibly knowing all true propositions, which is logically possible for a temporal being to know at the time that it is now. And this, they'll usually say, excludes true propositions about the future, especially, about the future actions of free creatures. So that's omniscience and eternality, as they're understood somewhat variously then, internal to the theistic community. Let me turn to the next property on my list, God's perfect freedom. As with knowledge, philosophers are not at all agreed about what freedom involves. Fortunately, as with knowledge, we don't need to know exactly what it involves in order to make some progress. Most would agree that freedom requires, or perhaps simply is, the ability to bring about what one reasonably desires. I suggest that the only things that make agents less than perfectly free in their choices are their not being sufficiently powerful and their not knowing what it is they're doing. In other words, I suggest that if the answer to the question, did you freely choose to do that, as posed of some action of yours, if the answer to that question is ever no, I didn't freely choose to do it, then that'll be because of one of two reasons, or a combination. Either because you recognise that what you were doing was less than ideal, but simply didn't have it within your power to do anything better, or because you didn't realise exactly what it was you were doing as you were doing it. You might think, how can you combine those? Well, it would be a sort of confused state. Oh, I sort of realised what I was doing, but and so on. Okay, it's easier to keep them separate. God, as we've seen, is omnipotent, so he could never be less than perfectly free in what he chose to do as a result of not having enough power to do anything that was more to his liking, as it were. And God is omniscient, so he could never be less than perfectly free in what he chose to do as a result of not knowing exactly what it was he was doing. There are none of the limitations on God's freedom that there are on ours. His ability to bring about what he reasonably wants is unhindered by either a lack of power or a lack of knowledge, and it's in virtue of this that we describe him as perfectly free. Theists believe that God is perfectly free. We are free to do evil actions as well as good. Does God have the ability to do evil actions? The traditional theistic answer to this has been that he doesn't have this ability. He cannot do any evil. Well, doesn't that make him less powerful than us then? That there's something we can do? He can't. And the traditional answer has been no, for the ability to do evil would be a liability rather than a power for God. So let me turn then to the next property on my list, perfect goodness. Before I do so, I just want to state explicitly an assumption that all theists are agreed on making, and this is the assumption which forms the foundation for their understanding of this property, perfect goodness. This is the assumption that there is, in some sense, objective goodness, badness, value. All agree, then, all theists agree, that moral appraisal isn't simply a matter of how subjectively people feel about the world. It's a matter of how objectively the world is or ought to be. Now, if you're not of this meta-ethical viewpoint, and of course a lot of people aren't, there, some sort of subjectivist or intersubjectivist or anti-realist or whatever it is, or quasi-realist, well, if you're not of this objectivist, realist kind of persuasion, you won't have much luck understanding the divine property of God's perfect goodness unless you appreciate that theists radically disagree with you at that starting point. Now, needless to say, I don't have time to go into the pros and cons of this sort of meta-ethical assumption at this stage, so I just refer you to a bit of reading if you're interested. In this case, Bernard Williams's Morality and Introduction to Ethics on the handout. It's a commendably clear book, no less commendably. It's a short book, and it has a good discussion in the middle somewhere about the Euthyphro dilemma, which is an issue which we'll come to in a future lecture. Could easily read it in an afternoon. Anyway, assuming some form of objectivism is true, then, for the sake of this argument, we're not going to question that, let me go on to look at God's perfect goodness as theists understand it. Now, goodness is a matter of doing the best one can whenever there is a best, or perhaps for finite creatures such as us, it's doing the best that one can perceive it. God's omnipotence, so the best that he can do will be whatever it is that's the logically possibly best action, and God's omniscient, so he'll always know what the best thing to do is, if there is a best thing. So God's perfect goodness is thus a matter of his doing the best action whenever there is a best action. And there's a little bit of a cautionary note about that too at the bottom of side two you might want to just read. It doesn't affect the substance of what's said, but it is important for nuancing it so as to meet some potential objections. So that's, with that cautionary note, what theists mean when they say that God is perfectly good. But why is it that they say that God is necessarily perfectly good? Why do they make his goodness an essential property of him rather than an accidental one? Well, we should remember that all theists are agreed that goodness is an objective property of some actions, states of affairs, or people, and that an action's being good is an objectively good reason for one to perform it. So with that assumption as a given, let me ask the question, why are we, finite humans, less than perfectly good ever? Well, as a first stab at the answer, we might say that we're less than perfectly good either because we are unreasonable or because we're ignorant. In other words, we're less than perfectly good for one or mixed or version of these two reasons. Firstly, it might be because we know what we should do and we genuinely do want to do it, but we find ourselves unable to bring our actions under the control of our will. To this extent, then, we're less than perfectly free. We're being acted on by forces, perhaps desires, strong desires, that are beyond our control. God cannot be less than perfectly free. There are no forces beyond his control, so he'll never be in this position, so he'll never be less than perfectly good for this reason. Secondly, it might be because we're ignorant of moral truth. We just don't know what it is that we should do. And God, of course, could never find himself in that situation as a result of his omniscience, so he'll never fail to be perfectly good for that reason. So God, in contrast to us, can never be less than perfectly morally good. The ability to do an action that's less than morally ideal is always a liability, not a power. Well, for him anyway. It's a liability which God's omnipotence and omniscience frees us from. Okay, now I think that is right, but someone might argue in this way against it. They might argue that the ability, without any weakness of will and in full knowledge of what one's doing, to do an action that's less than morally ideal sometimes just is a power rather than a liability. And I hope to show that whilst there is indeed some plausibility in this, indeed I think it's true, for finite creatures such as ourselves, even if it's right, it wouldn't be a power for God. In that respect, it's a bit like suicide. It could be a power for us to be able to do something less than morally perfect, wouldn't be a power for God. Consider the following situation. You're walking to your college, wondering how you're going to tell the bursar that you don't have the £500 that he says he requires of you today if he's not to send the handyman round to kneecap you. You're about to go into the college when you notice a banker on the street outside, a banker drop a wad of money just in front of you. He's not noticed this as he's busy slapping his chauffeur for being a few minutes late in picking him up in his Rolls Royce. You must act quickly if you are to return this roll of money to its rightful owner, because by now the banker is inside his Rolls Royce shouting at his chauffeur to drive over those worthless peasants, referring to the primary school children who are at the moment in front of the car. As you pick up the wad of money, you notice that it's sealed with a tape, which tells you that it contains exactly £500. As you look back to its rightful owner, you see that he set light to an identical roll of money and is using that lit roll of money to light a cigar and then throwing it away. What should you do? What is it overall most reasonable for you to do? And are these the same? What morally should you do? What would be the morally right thing? What is it overall reasonable for you to do? Are they the same? Well, if you're a consequentialist, you might argue that it's pretty obvious you should keep the money yourself. Consequentialism, for the benefit of those who've not studied philosophy before, the theory that the rightness or wrongness of an action is determined by the consequences it brings about, roughly speaking, how much good it brings into the world. The so-called rightful owner, on consequentialism, has no rights to this money because he's not going to use it to produce as much good as you are. Then, what you should do, what would be most reasonable doing, one and the same thing, keeping the money. If you do think that way, then my example won't really work in the way that I'd hoped it would. If you're not a consequentialist, though, and most people aren't, then I'd hazard that you'll probably think I've managed to describe a situation where you'd be overall reasonable in keeping the money to yourself, and in due course handing it to the bursar, even though morally, technically, you ought to give it back to its rightful owner, the man in the Rolls Royce. Okay, from this example then, you'll be able to conclude, if you do think of it as such an example, that it is possible for it to be overall most reasonable for you to do something other than what morality requires of you. And if so, I suggest one must think that the ability to, without any weakness of will, fully knowing what one's doing, sometimes the ability to do an action that one knows one shouldn't do, that it's less than morally ideal, is sometimes nevertheless a power for one. You have the power in that situation of being able to take the money off and pay it to the bursar, and that would genuinely be in a power rather than a liability. However, the crucial question in this context is, could it ever be a power rather than a liability for God to be less than morally ideal? And I think the answer is no, and that the case is analogous to suicide. So let me try and convince you of that. I think I can show that by altering the example. So let's suppose that as you're reflecting on whether or not it would be reasonable for you to keep this man's money or to give him his money back, you remember something somewhat surprising for an undergraduate, which is that you are governor of the Bank of England. And also, in an equally surprising sort of twist, the Chancellor has given you permission to print money on demand for your own purposes. Would it now be overall reasonable for you to keep this man's money too? Well, surely not. If, as I've been supposing, you really ought to return it, and objectivism is true, so what you ought to do is a reason for you to do that thing. If, as I've been supposing, you really ought to return it, then now you have no need of it. It certainly becomes unreasonable for you not to do what you ought to do. In other words, the ability knowingly and without any weakness of will to do an action that's less than morally ideal is only plausibly a power when one's in a situation where one has reasons to desire an outcome that one cannot achieve without deviating from what morality requires of one, and where these reasons outweigh the reasons to be moral. God's omnipotence assures him of being able to get whatever it is he reasonably desires without ever deviating from what morality requires. So to ask the question whether God has the ability to perform an action that's less than morally ideal is to ask whether he has the ability to perform an action which of necessity there's good reason for him not to perform. It is, after all, not morally ideal, and which, being omnipotent, he needn't perform in order to get anything else he might reasonably want. In other words, it's to ask whether he has the ability to perform an overall unreasonable action. And to answer that question, no, then, is obviously not in any way to retreat from the claim that he's omnipotent. Well, quite the contrary. Such an ability, then, would be, for him, always a liability. It can never be a power. God cannot ever do anything less than the moral ideal. He is necessarily perfectly good. Lord Acton told us that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and perhaps he was right about humans, but if I'm right, then of God, absolute power perfects necessarily. Okay, so let me turn on to the final property on my list of essential properties, necessity. There are many sorts of necessity. There's logical and mathematical necessity. If he's a bachelor, he cannot be married. Every number must have a successor. There's what's usually called metaphysical necessity. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. There's physical necessity. If it was a massive object, it couldn't have been travelling faster than the speed of light. There's moral necessity. You must make an effort to pay your debts. There's aesthetic necessity. By Act 3, it's impossible for Hamlet to live happily ever after, and so on. In what sense are necessary do theists regard God's existence as necessary? Some have held that God's existence is logically necessary, that one actually contradicts oneself, albeit perhaps in a non-obvious way, if one says of God that he doesn't exist. Anselm and Descartes thought that, and as we'll see in a future lecture, it forms the basis of the ontological argument for the existence of God. But that's been a minority opinion amongst theists. Most theists have understood the necessity of God's existence as some form of metaphysical necessity. Unfortunately, metaphysical necessity is notoriously difficult to elucidate. Most philosophers have agreed that there is such a thing as metaphysical necessity, but there's no consensus over how to understand it. Assume for a moment that it's true that there are no metaphysical necessities, i.e. no necessities which are not purely conceptual, like logical or mathematical ones, physical, like statements of scientific laws, or moral, like statements of fundamental principles, push aesthetics to the side. Is it just an accident that there are no metaphysical necessities? Could there have been some, even though there aren't, in fact, could there have been metaphysical necessities? If we say that yes, there could have been metaphysical necessities, well then we're saying that it's not necessary, that there are none. If we say that no, there couldn't have been any metaphysical necessities, not just an accident there are none, there couldn't have been any, well then we're saying that it is necessary that there are none. In either case then, we're making a claim that employs a notion of necessity. Well, what sort of necessity are we using to make that claim, the claim that there are no metaphysical necessities and couldn't have been any, or could have been some? Well, it's hardly going to be plausible to maintain that it's a conceptual necessity that we're using. Those who say that there are metaphysical necessities don't seem to be conceptually confused, and those who say that there are not do not take themselves to be merely stating a conceptual relationship, something to be placed on the shelf alongside such claims as there are no married bachelors. Then it's even less plausible to say that it's a physical necessity. The putative fact that there are no metaphysical necessities doesn't seem to be a fact which should be placed on the shelf alongside the laws of nature either. And it's even less plausible a moral necessity or aesthetic necessity to place alongside the fundamental principles of practical reasoning or aesthetic appreciation. So, the most consistent view, you might think, the view you'd be driven to anyway before you realise its inconsistency, is that it must be a metaphysical necessity that there are no metaphysical necessities, or a metaphysical necessity that there could have been some metaphysical necessities, and it's just contingent metaphysically that there are none. But each of those claims is a straightforward contradiction. So I think we should accept that there are metaphysical necessities, even if we're not quite sure how to elucidate the notion. I wonder what you make of that argument. Have a think about it. Is that good? Is that a good argument for why there are these metaphysical necessities? Maybe not. All theists are agreed, then, that God's existence is necessary, in the sense that if it's true that there's a God, then the fact that it's true is in no way dependent on any other fact. Rather, every other fact depends on it. All theists agree that it's no mere accident that there's a God. In some sense, the world could have not existed. That's the thought that prepares the mind for religion. Of course, it may be a wrong thought, but if it's a right thought, then there must be this crucial difference between the world and God, in virtue of which the riddle set by the world can be answered by God. God must be necessary, must be such that he couldn't have not existed. As I say, whilst all theists are agreed on this, they're disagreed over how this ontological independence, this could not have not existed property, is to be understood. Some say it's a logical necessity, most say it's metaphysical, and I've inclined to give you arguments in favour of supporting the claim that it's metaphysical. All right, so in these first two lectures, I've discussed the nine essential properties of God. All theists agreed on his personality, he's been personal, his incorporeality, my preferred term was transcendence, his omnipresence, my preferred term immanence, omnipotence, omniscience, eternality, his perfect freedom, his perfect goodness, and his necessity. Now, as I talked about these essential properties of God, you may have noticed that they were very far from being entirely conceptually autonomous from one another. As I got later on in my list of properties, rather than simply elucidating what theists understand by these properties, I started arguing why it was that God would need to have these properties given some of the other properties that I'd already discussed. being omnipotent and omniscient, I argued, entailed his perfect freedom. They entailed that there was nothing which constrained God's actions, no external power that could trump his will, and no ignorance that could misdirect it. So you get perfect freedom out of omnipotence and omniscience. Given his perfect freedom, I argued, he could not but be perfectly good, for he'd never have any incentive to do anything less than perfectly good. His omnipotence would entail that he could do the best thing possible, his omniscience that he knows what the best thing to do was. So you get that out of those. I might have argued in the other direction. In order to be perfectly good, God must be omnipotent, so that he can always do what's best. How can you be perfectly good if you were in some ways effete? And omniscient, so that he knows what the best is. How could you be perfectly good if you were bodging things up, even with the best of intentions, didn't know what you were doing? This then could have led me back to transcendence and immanence. In order to be omnipotent, God cannot depend on anything, including any physical thing, for his existence, nor can any physical thing be beyond his direct control. So he must be both transcendent and immanent. The terms I preferred for the properties of incorporeality and omnipresence, as discussed last week's lecture. God's omnipotence also entails that everything depends on him, and he depends on nothing else, so that he is in that sense necessary. And if he's necessary, then he must be eternal. There cannot be anything that could cause him to cease to exist. So he must be either outside time or inside time, but everlasting, the two views theirs have on God's internality. In other words, it looks as if there are various more or less obvious conceptual connections between the divine properties on my list. It looks as if at least some of these properties could be seen as aspects of other more fundamental ones. I think that something that's usually called the doctrine of divine simplicity, a traditional view amongst theists, is best understood as stating that the nine properties that I've distinguished in my list are in fact more correctly thought of as various aspects of one simple property, divinity. In other words, the doctrine of divine simplicity is best taken as stating that God's nature in itself is unitary and simple. The fact that I endorse the doctrine of divine simplicity under that interpretation might come as rather a surprise to you. You might think, if the divine nature is so unitary and simple, why has he spent a couple of lectures dividing it up and talking about it? The doctrine of divine simplicity doesn't say that God's nature will always appear unitary and simple when it's being talked about by lecturers. It just says that it is unitary and simple. The sort of unity and simplicity in question, then, is rather like that associated with beauty in metamathematics. Imagine that, instead of coming here today, you decided to attend a lecture on Gödel's second incompleteness theorem. So it was that you're sitting in another room, hearing another lecturer going through that argument step by step. Unfortunately, despite his or her best efforts, it's all looking rather opaque. It's as if the whole argument lies beneath a mist, which only lifts occasionally over the section that happened to be being talked about by the lecturer at that time. When it lifts, then, for a moment or two, you can see the part of the argument he's talking about more or less clearly. But even then, it still looks oddly complicated. You can discern how its parts relate to one another, but their purpose in a larger whole remains entirely opaque. Each time the lecturer moves on, the details of the section previously discussed become fuzzy in your recollection, and by the time the fog lifts over the next section, it's well and truly closed over the previous one. So you're about to give up and commit to coming back to this series of lectures, even though they weren't as unhelpful as this. That's my example, so allow me some leeway. Suddenly, however, perhaps as a result of a chance comment or analogy that the lecturer uses, or perhaps for no obvious reason at all, the mist lifts over the whole. Suddenly the outlines of the whole argument become, maybe only for a moment or two, clear in your mind's eye. That visibly the whole argument works. You see, albeit impressionistically, how the parts that seem to you oddly complicated when they were considered in isolation, in fact form a simple structure when you do that which previously you couldn't do, consider them together. As you focus down on one section of the argument again, the rest clouds over once more, but you know now that you've seen the whole, and the whole is, as the lecturer insisted on telling it was, simple. Okay, so the classical theistic concept of God is the concept of a being whose essence is, I suggest, unitary and simple. It's the partial understanding forced on us by our finite minds that introduces apparent complexities which require the sort of philosophy of religion that I've been talking about in these first two lectures. The sort of philosophy of religion which divides the divine nature up artificially into more manageable sections, so that it's best to remove any confusions we might have in our understanding of those sections, and then seeks to put them back together again, hopefully enabling us to see them now as facets of the simple property of divinity. That's what I've been trying to do, and how successful I've been is up to you to judge. Is it the case that, in fact, the divine nature is unitary and simple, as the doctrine of divine simplicity, as I've articulated it, decrees. And is it the case that it is unitary and simple? And your lecturer, insofar as it doesn't appear so to you, it's to be put down to your lecturer's fault in not having explained it properly. Or is it the case that, no, your lecturer's made the best of a bad job because the divine nature isn't that unitary and simple after all, and his attempts to make it appear so are attempts to sort of square circles to make the impossible possible. Well, I'll leave you to adjudicate between those two options. It's time for me to finish now. We've got a couple of minutes for questions. I'm aware that some of you will want to go to other lectures and the like, so those who want to be away quickly, leave quietly, and anyone who wants to stay and ask a question, please do so. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for that.